Hi, I'm Anne Strangechamps. When I walked into my local coffee shop the other day, a guy on the other side of the room stood up and smiled and waved at me. And so I smiled and waved back, and then I realized he wasn't even looking at me. He was waving at the woman behind me. Awkward. This kind of thing happens to me all the time. Probably to you, too. I think a stranger asked me a question, and I'm partway through the answer when I realize she was talking on the phone. I pass someone on the street, and just as our eyes meet, I trip over my own feet. This kind of stuff can make you want to crawl into a hole. Instead, today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're going to share the shame. Let's talk about awkwardness. Beginning with the most awkward, embarrassing time of all, the teenage years.
Hello, Leslie. How is your day today? Mine's quite well, I must admit. I do hope that yours is a good one, because what you are about to read may or may not add an extra color to the rainbow at day's end.
A couple of years ago, Dave Nadelberg was rummaging through his parents' attic when he discovered this, an old letter that he wrote as a teenager, a letter to a girl he had a crush on, a girl who probably didn't even know his name.
The older we all get, and the more the time that we include into history passes on, it has seemingly become harder and harder to get to know one another. So to keep up with the difficulties of modern times, I have devised four ways of introducing myself in the best possible manner.
So this is painfully awkward, right? And the letter goes on and on. I mean, if I had written it, I would burn it before I let anyone see it. But not Dave. He began reading this letter out loud to coworkers, roommates, anyone who would listen, and finally, on stage, to a theater full of complete strangers.
Look, I hope you will consider this letter. I promise you that you won't be disappointed. Besides, how many times in your life do you think someone will give you something like this? I hope for you the answer is many. But until then, all I ask of you is to just try me and see if you like me.
Teenage Dave did not get the girl. But today, his mortified stage show has become a storytelling movement. He brings together people from all walks of life who come up on stage and they share and celebrate the most awkward, embarrassing stories from their teenage years. The show is in nearly 20 cities now. It's also spawned a movie, a TV series, and a hugely popular podcast. So let's go back to that first night when he first stepped on stage with that letter.
The first time we got on stage to do a reading, it was actually on Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles, and it was so weird. I didn't know, is this going to be funny past 3 minutes? And, like, you know, the audience just loved it. And literally at the end, they were like, well, when's the next one? And I was like, I don't know. I just did this for a lark because I was having a crappy time and I wanted to do something that just brought some joy and fun into my life and into other people's lives. And so little did I know.
So as you said, by now, you know, this single performance led to a hugely popular live storytelling series. You've got stage shows in at least 20 different cities. There's a TV show, a movie, a podcast. Why do you think this concept has caught on so?
I think audiences, in particular in this era, are increasingly hungry for something that feels authentic, feels real. And I think the appetite for that is because maybe we as audience members find that nourishing, find that entertaining and engaging, but we don't get enough of that in our lives.
Well, Diary, I was sitting on the bus today at school. I literally have no idea why, but I guess I just started thinking about how I wanted to kiss someone. So I made a mouth with my hand and started practicing. It was only a second. But Jeremy stuck his head over the bus seat and started screaming, "This girl is making out with her hand." I just kept yelling that it wasn't true. It was too late, though.
So when I was 16, I had a huge crush on a boy, and I would never, ever have dreamed of telling him. But I did keep a diary and confessed in probably mortifying detail and probably terrible purple prose just how I felt. And then my younger sister found it, and recited portions of it out loud to our parents, which I still think of as one of the most mortifying experiences. So I think standing on stage and reading my old diary out loud today would be 10 times worse than that. Why would anybody want to do that?
I think hearing the laughter is very supportive. And I think you wind up feeling like that kid is acknowledged, that that voice was heard. Like when we get emails from teenagers, that's exactly why they're writing. That's a lot of what they kind of wind up talking to us about is how it makes them feel not so alone.
Well, I was thinking about that. I was thinking, I guess if the story you're going to share is something deeply embarrassing, kind of mortifying, humiliating in some way, sharing it with a room full of strangers is a way of pulling its teeth in a way. You know, if you can share this story of this humiliating thing that happened to you with a room full of strangers, then truly this story, this experience has no power over you anymore. So is that part of it?
That's exactly right. It's very much this burial of your awkward teenage self, you know, and not even sort of a sad one. It's just sort of like it's a way to put something, a relationship that you don't even realize that you still wrestle with. It's a way to put some of that relationship to rest.
I was in love in eighth grade with this girl named Sarah O'Donnell, and she hit puberty early, and she was like that girl. And I was a very shy kid, but I longed for her. Our eighth grade trip, we went to Washington, D.C., and the last night of the trip, we were on this dinner cruise, and she grabbed my hand, and we went up, and I didn't say no. We went right up to the top of the boat, and she took my head like it was a little grapefruit, and she just stuck her tongue way down my throat. It was too much, too fast, and I pulled back, and projectile vomited all over her.
The thing is, when you have one of these experiences, especially as a teenager, you know, of humiliation or shame or awkwardness, you almost always feel like you're the only one on the planet ever to do anything so embarrassing. You know, it's like you've just stepped into your own personal private zone of deep uncoolness while everybody else is out there behaving normally. But it sounds like one of the messages and one of the maybe the reasons people love your shows so much is it turns out that everybody can relate.
Yeah, that's I hope that's true. I know that anytime I'm laughing and mortified and anytime the audience is laughing and mortified, it's not because they say in their brain, oh, I had this verbatim experience too. It's that there's some underlying kernel of humanity that they connect with. And so that we wind up I think relating to stories, even if they're from a total different time, place, or culture.
It does sort of seem, though, that mortified taps into something specific about our current cultural moment. It's almost as if it's now cool to be awkward. I mean, you have young people calling out awkward situations. There are TV shows and movies that just revel in, you know, cringeworthy moments. There's a website that showcases awkward family photographs. And what is it about awkwardness that we like so much?
I think it's just this sense of honesty. I think it goes back to that hunger that is in culture.
I'm trying to think about how it is we all recognize each other. Because honestly, we're talking and I'm guessing that both of us spent a fair portion of our high school teenage years feeling like outcasts or pariahs in some way or another. And I always feel like I kind of recognize that in other people. Most of the people I wind up being friends with have had that experience at some point or another. But it's curious to me. I'm not quite sure how we recognize that in each other.
You mean like gaydar, but for dorks or?
Yes. Former dorks, please. yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like, I've always been a very social animal. Like, I've always had friends. But I did experience, you know, a pretty heavy, like, I've dealt with depression most of my adult life. And that began in high school. And I remember there were, you know, times of a fairly intense loneliness. And for me, I do think part of the desire for mortified comes a little bit from that time because I know the thing that has always gotten me out of bad, sad moments in life has been community, has been feeling the love of togetherness, of camaraderie.
Do you think there are people who never feel awkward?
Yes. They're just people I don't want to know. You know what I mean? I want someone to – I like people who are insecure. I don't want their lives to be run by insecurity. I want people to be weird and neurotic. And I also want them to believe in themselves and be confident. But if somebody was just void of any of that embarrassment or humiliated about themselves, I have met those people and I think they're robots. And I don't want to – they don't contribute to my life. I don't think I learn from them. I guess I'm mean. Now I feel like a jerk.
That's Dave Nadelberg. He's the founder of The Mortified Stage Show and podcast. What is it about awkwardness that we can't seem to get enough of? I mean, given the success of cringe comedies like The Office, 30 Rock, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you'd think there's something really appealing about social discomfort. Philosopher Adam Kotzko says our fascination with awkwardness is more than just entertainment. It actually defines our modern era. He says we live in an age of awkwardness, which he traces back to the social upheavals of the 1960s. Steve Paulson talked with him.
Adam, I have to say awkwardness would seem to be a pretty surprising topic for philosophical inquiry. How does awkwardness help to explain the age that we live in?
We're at a point where a lot of the traditional post-war values are no longer convincing to people. They're even viewed as oppressive by a lot of people, but at the same time, no agreed-upon replacement has arisen. And that leads to a feeling of awkwardness because I view awkwardness as basically what happens when you don't know what to do, when there's no pre-given rule for how you're supposed to interact.
So the social conventions have kind of broken down a little bit and people are at a loss?
Yes.
Give me a few examples of this.
Kind of the classic example is basically when a white heterosexual man feels like he needs to ask a woman on a date. It's a very fraught situation. Often you're kind of crossing boundaries between like maybe coworker or friend or service worker and into the romantic realm. So that transition is awkward and hard to navigate. And then there's also a certain anxiety produced by a perception that feminism has rendered women hostile or overly defensive against male advances. There's always the worry that you're going to be harassing her, that unwelcome attention is going to be have this exaggerated negative reaction.
So you don't know what to do. I mean, that's the core element of being awkward or feeling like you're in an awkward situation.
Right. And I think this is an interesting one because for a non-neurotic person, it's pretty straightforward what you should do. You should just ask the person to go do the thing that you want to do. What makes it awkward, I think, is the person's feeling that there should be some set rule, that there should be some way that you go about it that guarantees success, when in reality we know there is not.
Hmm. Okay. So give me one or two other examples of what you mean by awkwardness.
Sorry, I really focused on the first example. This is awkward. Well, I think there's a certain awkwardness that comes up, you know, whenever paths cross, whenever situations overlap and you don't know which one you're supposed to be acting according to, like going out and getting drinks with coworkers after work. Are they coworkers? Are they friends? Can you talk about non-work things? You know, there's a kind of fraughtness to the situation. And there's a similar type of awkwardness in kind of cross-cultural encounters. Americans are especially bad about this. We proverbially try to make up for the awkwardness of not sharing a language by like speaking more loudly and slowly for the other person so they can catch on, that kind of thing. But really, that's just a symbol that we're at a loss and don't know what to do.
Is this a personal matter for you? I mean, do you find yourself in these sorts of awkward situations?
Well, of course. I mean, we all do.
So this is more you're wearing your philosophical hat more than you're sort of trying to work out personal issues here.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So what you're doing is kind of fascinating. I mean, it sounds like you are using the lens of awkwardness to explore something profound about the nature of our social interactions.
Yeah, I do think that it's not just limited to the current American scene, that kind of the breakdown of the social norms that we're experiencing allows us a privileged access to something that was always lying underneath that might not have been as clear in a stronger and more self-assured social order.
So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that the social norms have changed so much in recent decades. What, just because we recognize more the different kinds of people in our society and we've sort of lost the ability to talk with each other in a straightforward way?
I think that in recent decades, there's been a greater recognition and embrace of diversity in American culture, but there has not been a development of a strong set of shared norms for how to navigate that space of diversity. There was a kind of failed attempt in the form of what the right wing pillories as political correctness, probably in the late 80s and early 90s. And we see student activists and online activists trying to develop a vocabulary, but the very fact that it's new emphasizes its artificiality and renders it kind of less convincing to people. And I think that the student activists who are trying to come up with different ways of navigating these interpersonal encounters, I think that they're reacting to the fundamental awkwardness of our age.
Hmm. You know, one thing that's so intriguing is it almost seems like awkwardness is something that people are attracted to.
Oh, definitely. I mean, this is especially the case in the younger generation, the same kind of population that's going through all these protest movements and trying to develop new norms. They're also the same people who kind of revel in awkwardness. And I think that the reason is that there's a two-edged sword when you don't have a social norm. On the one hand, you don't have it to reassure you, to make you feel confident, to kind of make you feel like you know what to do. But on the other hand, the social norm can also feel very constricting and confining. And so being released from that and being able to give kind of free play to your desire, I think, is attractive as well as being scary.
So being awkward in public somehow makes you look good or desirable?
Well, it can be in some cases. For instance, you know, when younger people will, you know, say awkward, they're kind of trying to avoid the kind of shame and embarrassment and just like laugh at the fact that their awkwardness and incite others to laugh as well.
So it's sort of, I guess, acknowledging that awkwardness is just part of daily life now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that it holds the potential for kind of a more humane and livable approach to social norms, that they don't have to be this constricting thing that anticipates every contingency, that you can go through life like grasping it a little looser and allowing room for awkwardness, which I think means allowing room for other people to be people.
Philosopher Adam Kotzko is the author of Awkwardness. Steve Paulson talked with him. And coming up, the mother of all awkward situations, a guy at a pickup bar.
What are you drinking? It's so weird how people drink alcohol at these places so that they can talk to each other. Alcohol is poison, you know.
I'm Anne Strain-Champs. Actor Jesse Eisenberg tells an awkward story after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about awkwardness in this hour. And can there be anything more awkward than a guy trying and failing to pick up a woman at a bar? Here's what not to say when introducing yourself. In the words of actor and writer Jesse Eisenberg.
Hey, how's it going? Mind if I sidle up? I saw you over here sitting alone, and I started crying. In a way, we're all alone. But to be alone at a bar, at a place specifically designed to meet other humans, and what are humans? We're all just carbon-based light refractions anyway, was particularly unnerving. Do you want a piece of gum? I have four left. Are you waiting for someone? It's always so awkward to approach a person at a bar and then find out they're waiting for someone else. I was waiting for someone tonight as well, but she never showed. It was my mother, who died in a car accident when I was 7. She's not really dead. I just lied to you because I'm in denial because she actually is dead. It's like when the baby panda is torn away from its mother by a scientist, but I'm the baby panda, and my mother is the mother panda, and the scientist is my mother's faulty brake pads. Have you ever watched baseball? Do you know how to make fire? I would die in the wild. So do you want to go out with me? Just kidding. We're already here. We're out. What is out? We're all carbon-based. Do you want to have sex with me is what I really meant to ask you. Do you? I mean, not here, of course. It would be gauche, and my mother could walk in at any moment. But we could go back to my apartment, which smells because I rarely flush the toilet because I think I'm conserving water. But I flushed it before I came here in anticipation of meeting someone like you who would be disgusted by something like that. There's only 2 pieces of gum left. Time is running out on this gum. We'll all be dead in 100 years. What are you drinking? It's so weird how people drink alcohol at these places so that they can talk to each other. Alcohol is poison, you know. It's all poison, made from rotting fruits and vegetables. Isn't that so weird? And then we get in our cars and drive home. What a great idea! Hey, let me sit inside this glass and metal death cage and drive at 60 miles an hour in the dark. It's not like I have a son who needs me. You have really beautiful eyes, by the way. The way the light in your stroma scatters across your ocular fluid, creating a bluish-greenish color, is attractive to me for some reason. I also like your body. Your cleavage excites me on a carnal, albeit unsustainable level, and the fact that you're revealing your legs in that short skirt makes me feel like you're eager to have sex with someone, which I also am. Even though I know you're mostly carbon-based, and that we share most of the same chemical compounds, and that we're all just light refractions through space, I still want to have sex with you. And even though I know you're almost genetically identical to the woman at the far end of the bar with the slight overbite, I still want to have sex with you a lot more than I want to have sex with her. What's that? Your boyfriend just showed up? Oh yes, I can see why you prefer to date him. He is better looking than me. I'm ashamed of my physical body. I have a weird-looking sternum, but his looks more desirable. Does he make fire? Would he like my final piece of gum? Ah, yes. The sensation my face feels from you throwing your beer all over it is simply exhilarating. Thank you for enlivening my nervous system at this late hour. Ow! Thank you, sir, for punching me in the face to defend your girlfriend from my frantic advances. The blood is now rushing to my face in a desperate attempt to stave off the pain, and my prefrontal cortex is making a mental note to avoid carbon-based life forms with your properly aligned sternum. Okay, I'm leaving. If you see my mother, please tell her I'm in the bathroom wiping my face and nursing my wounds. And if the girl with the overbite appears to be leaving, tell her to wait a few minutes for me because I'd still be up for the sex. Have a good night, which is just an arbitrary illusion created by the Earth blocking the sun.
That's Jesse Eisenberg reading from his new collection of short stories, Bream Gives Me Hiccups. You could say that blogger Jenny Lawson has made a whole career out of embarrassing herself. She's been blogging and publishing books about her mortifying misadventures for years. So it wasn't all that remarkable when she tweeted about an awkward encounter at an airport. Here's what's crazy, though. That tweet went viral. Over the next couple of days, she got thousands of messages from fans recounting their own awkward moments.
Young male student held open a door for me at work. I said, "Thank you, good girl." I was thinking of my dog and I was very tired. Once while giving directions to an elderly couple, I told them that they were about 2 minutes away from intercourse. I meant to say interstate. The handsomest man I have ever seen once sat down next to me and said, "Hi." I responded with, "I'm eating a Tootsie Roll." He left. Went to the movie theater and asked for popcorn and Reese's penises.
That flood of responses underscored Jenny's own personal theory that there's an upside to awkwardness. She says that writing about her most mortifying moments, as well as about her struggles with mental illness, has helped her find and develop a whole community of supporters. She talked with Doug Gordon about how awkwardness brings people together.
What was really great about it is it sort of came from nowhere. And all of these people were like, "You know what? You're not the only one. We all go through this." And so all of these people decided, like, "Oh, I can top that." And what was great is you would laugh yourself to tears, but like every fourth one, you would be like, oh, I've done that. Yeah. I've totally done that.
Yeah. And did you have any idea that it would bring so many of you all together, that it would become so popular?
I did in a way, because my particular audience, they're used to the fact that what I write about is me mortifying myself.
Sure.
So I knew that they already enjoyed the idea of sharing this, but I had no clue how big it would get. And it, I mean, it got to the point where it was just sort of all over the place. Like the New York Times ended up doing a story about it and like brought in a psychiatrist to be like, what's wrong with these people? And the answer was, they're human. That's what's wrong with them.
Yeah. Why do you think it resonated so deeply with so many people? Just because everyone could relate to it?
I think it's two things. I think one, that everyone can relate to it. I think two, because people started sharing the truly embarrassing moments, the ones where you're just like, what is wrong with me? Everybody felt like it's probably okay for me to share this moment. And what I think is so great is everybody has those horrible moments where you think back on them and you just cringe and you think, oh, like I can still feel the pain of that thing that happened to me in seventh grade. And then they would share it and it would be retweeted 1,000 times and all these people responding and saying, oh my God, that happened to me. And other people saying, oh, you made me laugh for the first time in a week. And so many people were like, this was the first time I've ever talked about this out loud. And oh my gosh, I feel like I have all these friends now who completely understand me. And it, what was great is you would see people following each other because they would be like, oh, this is the exact same awkward that I am. You're my friend. And I just, I love that because I think so often we try to be like, look at me, I'm so cool. Look at the, I don't know, fancy shoes that I have or, you know, whatever. And instead, the people that we really want to sort of follow their life and be friends with are the ones who are flawed and who make us feel like, oh, we're all in this together.
Yeah. So you are saying that awkwardness has this upside, that it can bring people together.
Absolutely. Like you can think of like the one person that you hold in the highest of esteem, or the Hollywood star that you want to be like, or the famous author or whatever. And they've all had something horrifically mortifying that has happened to them. And that's the thing that brings us all together. And I think it just, it reminds everyone that we're human, and especially when you can laugh about it. And I think it's so great. It's just, it's perfectly human.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. Now, your book, Furiously Happy, is filled with these hilarious, cringeworthy moments. And in fact, one could say you've made a whole career and a very lucrative and successful career based on mortifying yourself. But this is also a book about your own struggles with mental illness. Did writing about all of this so candidly give you any additional insight into the nature of depression?
It did. A lot of times when I would write about depression, I would sometimes get into a weird spot in my head where I sort of pushed myself into a bad place, and I would have to kind of pull myself back out. I also have some issues with suicidal ideation, which is just basically where you're a little obsessed with suicide, even though you're not suicidal. And writing about it can be a trigger. But at the same time, I was like, I don't want to not write about it, because if I don't, it's going to create this false history. So I did have to be very careful. I did have to take breaks, sometimes up to a month at a time. It took me years to write this book, but it was extremely helpful. And actually, one of the best things that came out about this book was the fact that my husband read it. And, you know, we've been married for 20 years. He sort of knew what he was getting into, you know. And this was the first time after reading this that I could see that he started to understand. And so in a way, this was sort of a manual that I could give to him and say, this is me.
That's great. And that's wonderful. The response your book has received, and that must make all the hard work and angst that went into writing it feel, you must feel very gratified.
Absolutely. I feel so incredibly lucky. And I've never had a reading where someone didn't come and say that they were saved, not because of something that I wrote, but because they saw the response of the rest of the world to what I wrote. When I first came out about mental illness years ago, when I wrote about it on my blog, and I thought that people would run away, and I thought that they would be scared. And instead, I had thousands and thousands of people who responded with me too. And I thought it was just me. And what is really amazing about that is so often people would come back and would say, I was actively in the process of planning my suicide. And I decided not to because I saw these thousands of people all saying, I feel worthless too. I feel like an imposter. And they looked at them and they were like, how could they possibly believe these lies that depression is telling them? And then they realized, maybe I should give myself the same benefit of the doubt that I give all of these people. And they decided to get help. And now they're alive. And in many cases, you know, for so many of the people that I meet who are part of the community, they are some of the most incredibly empathetic, compassionate people, because I think it does build in you this ability to see past everything else and to say, nobody is what they look like on the surface.
What I find fascinating is that for a lot of people with social anxiety and especially avoidant personality disorder, the tendency is to withdraw from the world and withhold personal information as a way of self-preservation. But you've gone the opposite route. Not only are you giving talks and going out on book tours, you're writing books about some of your most embarrassing moments. That's got to be incredibly exhausting, isn't it?
It is. The great thing about going out on book tour is that I know everyone in the audience gets it, and that at any moment I can duck behind the podium and say, I'm having a panic attack. You guys talk amongst yourselves, and they will just roll medication at me, and that it'll be fine. And that is a really wonderful thing, realizing that your community has your back. And I can look out at the audience, and every time before I go out on stage, I have complete panic, even though I do all the therapies, I'm on all the right medications. I still have that feeling of I want to run away. And as soon as I get out on the stage, I look out and I see people who look just as terrified as I do. And I think, I can do this. I will pretend that I can do this. And if I pretend that I can do this, then I can do this. And so far, it's worked.
Was it difficult to write so candidly about your struggles?
It was actually quite wonderful to be able to write about, especially the darker stuff, because I could put it down. And once I was done with it, I could shut the chapter forever, and that I had researched it and that I had explored it and that I had shared it and that people were going to treat me the way that they were going to treat me. And it was out there. It was scary, and it's still a little scary. And honestly, I have some friends and family who have sort of taken a step back and said, like, I don't understand this and I don't like it. And oh, like, you've pretty much devoted your life to this. And I'm like, no, I've devoted my life to staying alive. Mm-hmm. And that's a really wonderful thing. And so often I think, especially, you know, when you're dealing with depression and you just feel like, oh, I'm broken, I'll never be whole. And instead to celebrate those things is such a wonderful thing. So when I come out of a depression, I really try to celebrate the fact that I survived again. And you know what? There are people every day who don't survive it. And the fact that I'm still alive today means I'm still winning. And like, if you're hearing this today, that means you're still winning. And that's a wonderful thing.
Jenny Lawson is the author of Furiously Happy, a funny book about horrible things. Doug Gordon talked with her. We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, the scientist Darwin idolized and Thoreau imitated, Alexander von Humboldt. He was once the most famous scientist in the world. Today, almost no one remembers him except us. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. And now, Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Jennifer Jacquet. I'm an assistant professor at NYU's Department of Environmental Studies, and I'm the author of Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. I want to recommend today a book published by Douglas Adams and Mark Cowardine in 1990 called Last Chance to See. Mark Cowardine is a zoologist with the World Wildlife Fund, and Douglas Adams is our old friend who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and is best known for his science fiction, but actually wound up writing this fabulous book about seeing some of the world's most endangered animals. The book is part travelogue, part natural history, and partly a treatise on the extinction crisis. He travels all over the world to Indonesia and New Zealand and Zaire, which is now called the Congo, and even China, looking at the rarest species in the world. The best part about Douglas Adams is that he really never addresses anything head on. He tackles this really sad problem that we're faced with, which is the high rate of extinction, in this really beautiful and funny way that makes you, in the end, realize that he's sort of as depressed as you are about the whole thing, but refuses to sort of let it get him totally down. So here's a part where he's about to visit the gorillas. The gorillas were not the animals we had come to Zaire to look for. It is very hard, however, to come all the way to Zaire and not go and see them. I was going to say that this is because they are our closest living relatives, but I'm not sure that's an appropriate reason. Generally, in my experience, when you visit a country in which you have any relatives living, there's a tendency to want to lie low and hope they don't find out you're in town. At least with the gorillas, you know that there's no danger of having to go out to dinner with them and catch up on a million years of family history, so you can visit them with impunity. I love lines like that. Unfortunately, since he wrote the book, the Yangtze River dolphin, which he does feature, has been declared extinct. When he wrote the book in 1989, he was on the trip. There were 22 northern white rhinos, and today there are only 5, and they all live in captivity. So it really was his last chance to see. I am really interested in the idea of survivor guilt, but at a sort of species level, and it's something I myself really grapple with, feeling like humans are causing the extinction of so many animals, and we're going to survive and they're not. And I really look for writers who kind of feel this way too. And this book, by far, really got to that point. It's one of the best treatments of what I would describe as survivor guilt there is.
Jennifer Jacquet recommends Last Chance to See by Douglas Adams and Mark Cowardine. You can find more bookmarks and an interview with Jacquet on our website at ttbook.org. A German explorer and naturalist named Alexander von Humboldt was once the most famous scientist in the world. He inspired Darwin to go on his around-the-world trip. He showed Thoreau how to write Walden. There are more plants, animals, minerals, and places named after him than any other person. Oh, and he predicted man-made climate change in 1800. So how come most of us have never heard of this guy? Historian Andrea Wolf rescued Alexander von Humboldt this year with her biography, The Invention of Nature. It's on a lot of this year's best book lists, and Steve Paulson recently sat down with her.
Andrea, there was a time when Alexander von Humboldt was the most famous scientist in the world. He was widely revered. In fact, he was the guy who inspired Charles Darwin to go on his round-the-world trip on the HMS Beagle. And then today, outside of Germany, Humboldt has largely been forgotten. So take us back to Humboldt's day. What made him so special?
Well, he was, as you said, one of the most famous scientists of his age. And I'd like to say that he's actually mainly forgotten today in the English-speaking world. Interestingly, he is really super famous in Latin America, because one of the reasons why he was so famous is because he went on a 5-year exploration of Latin America in 1799, just before his 30th birthday. And he came back from this exploration with a completely new idea of nature. He came up with this idea that nature is a web of life. He described Earth as a living organism, which are ideas which we still very much believe today.
So this is kind of 200 years before the Gaia theory surfaced in our own time.
Yes, and the amazing thing is actually that Humboldt wrote a book in which he described all this, which was called Cosmos, but while it was still in manuscript, he considered the title Gaia for that book, which I think is just extraordinary, don't you think?
Now, you mentioned Humboldt's extraordinary five-year journey down to South America, deep into the Amazon rainforest by canoe, also high up into the Andes Mountains. What was he after? What was he looking for?
He was an incredibly restless mind. He said himself that he always felt like as if he was chased by 10,000 pigs. So he's this incredible, curious person. And he believes that a scientist really has to leave their studies and their labs. They have to be out in nature. And the extraordinary thing about him is that he has an incredible memory. So his mind can race back 30 years later to a particular plant he's seen. So what he's doing is he's connecting the whole world.
And for much of his expedition, he was hauling around a lot of heavy equipment to measure everything that he was seeing. Tell me what his expedition was like.
So he leaves Europe with 42 scientific instruments, all wrapped individually in velvet-lined boxes. So he schleps those around South America. But what he does is, I mean, his story is really one of great adventures because he was just so brazenly adventurous. So, for example, he paddled along the Orinoco and the surrounding river networks, 1,400 miles, 75 grueling days. And, you know, of course, this was incredibly dangerous. So they encountered crocodiles, snakes, jaguars, mosquitoes. Then he traveled to Cuba. He then went back to South America and traveled from the northern coast of what's today Colombia, 2,500 miles, all the way south to Lima in Peru. Much of this through the Andes. This is, you know, some of the harshest landscapes you can possibly imagine. And he climbs every reachable volcano on the way. In fact, he climbs Chimborazo, which is then believed to be the highest mountain in the world. And he goes up to just under 20,000 feet and holds the world record for several decades. So he's a physically very fit man also.
Well, tell me about that climb, because it sounded like it was high adventure. I mean, something that easily could have killed him.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, so I followed a few of his footsteps. And so I went to Venezuela and I went up the Chimborazo, not all the way up. And I have to say that with every footstep my admiration for him just grew because, of course, he didn't have great climbing equipment and stuff like that. So he goes up Chimborazo and he describes everything kind of in great detail. So the weather is terrible. The whole mountain is basically covered in fog. Their eyes are bloodshot, their gums are bleeding. They struggle to breathe in the thin air. The icy wind kind of numbs their hands and feet, and they're crawling up this kind of really narrow, high ridge. But he still stops every few hundred yards to take out his scientific instruments to measure everything. You know, of course you do that. And then they go on. And then at 19,400 feet, suddenly the fog lifts and they see this huge crevasse in front of them. So they can't go any further. But no one has ever been so high as they have. That's him and his traveling companion, the botanist Aimé Bonpland. And while Humboldt is standing there at the top of the world, really, his vision of nature clarifies and everything falls together. And when he comes down, he draws this incredible painting, which is a cross-section of the Chimborazo, on which he writes every single plant he's seen at a certain altitude. It's this incredible visualization of scientific data, which really he is the very, very first one to do so. Mm.
So he was mapping sort of the strata of plant life up and down the mountain.
Yes, and he realizes that a lot of the plants he was seeing there on his way up the Chimborazo were very similar to the plants he had seen elsewhere in Latin America, but also elsewhere in Europe. And he comes to this incredible conclusion that there are vegetation zones, global vegetation zones, and that no one had talked about this before.
And he had just some amazing experiences during his time in Latin America. For instance, you have to describe this experiment he had with electric eels. what was he doing there?
Everybody just loves that story. I have to say it's one of my favorite stories. Like many other scientists at that time, obsessed with something which is called animal electricity. They're kind of, at that time, believing that animals hold electricity. And he tries it out when he's still in Germany with frogs and fish and all kinds of stuff. And then he comes to Latin America and he hears about these strange things called electric eels. And they are huge. They're about 5 foot long and they discharge a voltage of about 600. So, you know, you touch them and you're dead, basically. So he can't just go and catch them. So the locals come up with this brilliant idea that because the eels live in the mud and ponds, so they get 30 wild horses and they charge the horses into the pond. Now, the horses' hooves then churn up the mud, so the electric eels panic and discharge their electricity. You know, a couple of horses drown, but then they just, by the time they've kind of discharged their electricity, you can then start touching them. So that's how Humboldt gets them. But he dissects them and some of them a little bit too early. So at the end of a whole day of experiments, he says, you know, we were very fatigued because they did get a few shocks.
Kind of dramatic. I mean, the lengths that he would go to try to figure out things.
Yes. I mean, and he does these things where he, and I like that a lot about him also, that he believes that the indigenous people can tell him a lot of things. So he always questions them. He calls them like they're the best observers of nature. And he tries out all kinds of stuff. Some is dangerous, some is not at all. So, for example, he hears or he sees them being able to distinguish 15 different species of trees by tasting the bark of the tree. So he tries that out and he says, like, well, it tastes to me completely the same. He's fascinated by the poison they use. So he gets some, puts it in a container. The container leaks. It touches his clothes. He almost dies. I mean, it's just extraordinary what this man does.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned also that he often connected with the people he met there. And it's worth pointing out, I mean, he comes from what was then Prussia. I mean, from an imperial power in Europe. But he didn't seem to have that kind of colonial mentality that a lot of people of that age did have.
Not at all. So he's a great believer in the French and the American Revolution. And we have to point out that he's actually financing this exploration on his own. So he can do whatever he wants in a way. He doesn't have to obey the command of kings and queens. He's fascinated by the indigenous people. And unlike most European, he does not regard them as savages. And he returns, for example, with sketches of Inca monuments and Aztec manuscripts. He also never stops criticizing colonialism and slavery. I mean, he writes some very, very straightforward books about this. He becomes a very good friend with Simon Bolivar, who liberates the Spanish colonies later. And Bolivar later says that Humboldt had awakened South America with his pen. So his descriptions of South America as this absolutely beautiful country with gorgeous landscapes. It's almost like as if he reminded the colonists just how magnificent their continent was.
Yeah. So once Humboldt got back to Europe after this, you know, long 5-year expedition, he wrote a 34-volume account of his journey, and a chunk of it was a travelogue, which came to be very influential. How would you describe his writing?
So there are several very different types of books. So he does one type of book which has incredibly beautiful engravings. They were very, very lavishly produced and very expensive. Then he does kind of some straightforward botanical volumes and zoological volumes. And then, and that's, I think, the amazing publications are really, he writes a lot of books which are a combination of evocative landscape descriptions with scientific observations. And with that, he created a completely new literary genre, and one that still is, I believe, the blueprint of a lot of nature writing today, because he brings together his emotional responses to nature with the scientific observations. So, for example, he writes one book which is called Personal Narrative, which is half a travel account of his exploration and half scientific observations. It's a book that inspires Charles Darwin to actually board the Beagle. So he is incredibly influential on Darwin, but also on John Muir, for example, who has a lot of copies of Humboldt's books, which amazingly still exist in an archive in California. And when you open these books, you can see how Muir kind of underlined and wrote in the end papers. So reading these books is like listening to Muir having a conversation with Humboldt.
And also, same with Henry David Thoreau as well. I mean, wasn't Walden actually deeply influenced by Humboldt?
Yes. So, I mean, basically, everybody in the 19th century was influenced by Humboldt. But yes, Thoreau, for example, he leaves Walden Pond in 1847, and he then turns those 2 years into one of the most famous pieces of American nature writing, Walden. But he struggled to write the manuscript. Thoreau was finding it difficult to find a balance between being a poet and a scientist because he was observing nature meticulously like a science, but he also obviously adored the beauty of nature. And he was devastated, and he just didn't know how to tackle it. And then he read Humboldt's Cosmos, and everything changed. And he discovered this new world where Humboldt described that you should use your feelings and your emotions to describe nature. And it was really an answer to his dilemma of how to be a poet and a scientist. And after he read it, he took out his manuscript for Walden and he completely rewrote it. So in a way, Walden is like a mini cosmos. It's a description of nature where everything is connected. It's a description of nature which is thumping with life. So there's a lot of inspiration from Humboldt in that book.
Andrea Wolf's biography of Alexander von Humboldt is called The Invention of Nature. And Steve Paulson talked with her. If you like what you heard this hour, subscribe to our podcast. Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you catch your podcasts. And if you really want to help us out, leave a review. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.